From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. We're keeping an eye on some primary elections today, including in Arizona, where Senator John McCain, who is supporting Donald Trump, is trying to hold off an anti-establishment, more outspoken Trump supporter named Kelly Ward.
And Arizona is one of two states whose election systems were hacked earlier this summer. One state, Illinois, lost data. And now the FBI is saying the attacks were by foreign hackers. It's thought that Russians might be involved, although the FBI is not confirming that. And the Department of Homeland Security is offering to help states make systems secure ahead of the general election, which is just 2 months away. All this news comes as Donald Trump alleges that Democrats are rigging the election for Hillary Clinton, and Democrats are openly wondering if Russia is hacking to help Trump. Michael Isikoff first reported the FBI alert for Yahoo News, where he's chief investigative correspondent. He's at NPR in D.C. Hi, Michael.
Good to be with you.
And we know that although the FBI didn't name the states, it's known that databases in Arizona and Illinois were hacked. Illinois had to shut down after data was taken. So how concerned are, you know, FBI and cybersecurity officials about all of this?
Pretty concerned. Look, this whole issue has gotten a lot more attention because of what we saw over the summer with the hack of Democratic National Committee and other political organizations in Washington by what U.S. officials believe were Russian intelligence hackers. This was state-sponsored hacking that seemed to be an effort to tamper or disrupt in some ways our election, because the hackers didn't just penetrate the Democratic National Committee. They exfiltrated emails and then dumped them, made them public, and had an impact. So you add on top of that what was going on at the same time, which is the FBI discovers that hackers have gotten into state election databases in Arizona and Illinois. In Illinois, they actually exfiltrated 200,000 voters' information about 200,000 voters. The Illinois Board of Elections had to shut down its database for about 10 days. And that really ramped up concerns that it was possible that the same folks who did the hack of the DNC might also seek to in some way disrupt or tamper with the election.
Well, you spoke to an Illinois election official who was briefed by FBI agents who told him that they were looking at this possible link to the attack at the DNC. But, you know, he said that the agents also said to him, look, it could have been, you know, criminals just looking to get tax information. What's your sense?
Well, look, exactly. We don't know at this point. We do, you know, there's some circumstantial evidence that does suggest this was, this may have been Russian hackers. One of the IP addresses that's listed in the FBI alert is an IP address that has popped up before in Russian criminal hack forums. Some of the techniques used do seem to parallel techniques that were used in a suspected Russian state-sponsored hack of the World Anti-Doping Agency over the summer. This has clearly ramped up concerns over the issue. You know, just 3 days before the FBI sent out this warning to state election officials, Jay Johnson, the Homeland Security Secretary, had a conference call with state election officials urging them to take certain steps. The Obama administration is considering designating state elections as part of the nation's critical infrastructure, like dams, like the power grid, that would require federal protection. So this is a very live issue in Washington right now.
Well, meantime, Jay Johnson is, you know, offering help to the states. But what can the states just be thinking of, simple things that they can do to avoid being hacked?
Well, there are certain sort of basic steps. Like in 40 states, it's optical scanning machines that are backed up by paper ballots. So those are pretty safe, reasonably safe. But in six states and parts of four others, there are electronic voting machines in which there are no paper ballots. So that is a point of vulnerability. One sort of basic step is to minimize when those machines are connected to the internet and certainly not around the day of voting. There's a whole other area of concern overseas in military. military ballots, which are done in 33 states through the internet. So that's an obvious point of vulnerability as well. One of the things the feds are recommending here is, as I said before, keep machines off the internet, bring in cybersecurity experts to scan for vulnerabilities of the systems, limit access to who has access to voting databases. But, you know, there's some pretty sophisticated actors out there that have gotten very good at hacking. And I don't think anybody can say that, you know, the threat is off the table.
Michael Isikoff, chief investigative journalist for Yahoo News. Michael, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, the outrage over the cost of a life-saving allergy drug has made its way to Congress. A House Oversight Committee is investigating what it calls an unreasonable price hike for the EpiPen. The company that makes it, Mylan, bowed to public pressure yesterday, saying it will sell a generic version for half the price, but still, that's $300 for a two-pack instead of $600. The same committee held hearings last winter into another infamous drug price hike when the so-called Pharma Bro CEO Martin Shkreli jacked the price of Daraprim from $13.50 to $750 overnight. Sarah Cliff covers health policy for Vox. She's with us now. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, we've heard these two high-profile stories recently, Martin Shkreli and Mylan dramatically raising their drug prices. How common is it for pharmaceutical companies to jack prices like this, and how often does it not make the headlines?
It happens a lot. It's something that's common. And I think when you look at these two high-profile cases we've had recently, they speak to a bigger issue that happens in that's very unique to the United States. We are one of the few developed countries that does not regulate our drug prices, which means that we can see these spikes kind of seem to happen out of nowhere when a pharmaceutical company decides they, you know, have a monopoly on a market, they want to charge more. There's really nothing stopping them from just hiking up their prices.
Is it just about profit? Because in the case of the EpiPen, Mylan's CEO's salary rose from about $2.5 million a year to almost $19 million a year as the price of the EpiPen was jacked up.
Yeah, so some of it certainly is about profit. If you look at the healthcare industry writ large, you do see that pharma companies do tend to have the largest profit margins. When you talk to pharmaceutical companies, the arguments that they'll make are about needing more money to make innovative new products. So if they are getting more money from the drugs they have in the market, they're able to invest that in research, they're able to create new drugs that are going to save lives, that are going to kind of push our medical knowledge forward. And there definitely is truth to that in the academic research. More spending on research and development does lead to better drugs. But at some point, you have questions of access. If we're making these great drugs that are saving lives, but no one can afford them, how useful are they to Americans?
You've been reporting about this, and you wrote in a story that you did, the American government is exceptional in that it has no power to regulate drug prices. Is that right? No power at all?
None. Actually, our Medicare system, which covers Americans over 65, is prohibited from negotiating drug prices. They are not allowed to ask for a lower price. So whatever pharmaceutical companies want to charge, they get to. And I loved, you know, a quote. I talked to one drug pricing expert who kind of put the pharmaceutical industry's dilemma this way. When the sky's the limit, what do you even charge?
How do other countries regulate drug pricing?
They essentially treat it as a utility, like electricity or water, something you need to survive. And, you know, if you look at Europe, basically the entire continent has some kind of body that will regulate drug prices, set, you know, this is what we're willing to pay for a price. Usually there's a negotiation with pharma. But because they're essentially buying in bulk, it's like when you go to Costco and, you know, you're willing to buy a lot of drugs, you can negotiate lower prices. In the United States, you know, Medicare doesn't negotiate. Insurance plans are very fragmented. There's millions of different insurance plans in the United States. So everyone's kind of buying a small amount of drugs, and that means they can't really get good deals with the pharmaceutical industry.
Do you expect all of the outrage and bipartisan outrage in the case of what Mylan has been doing to lead the Congress to actually change the way things are done when it comes to negotiating drug prices or setting limits in this country?
I am somewhat skeptical. You know, there definitely has been a movement by liberals to, you know, get to push for Medicare's ability to negotiate drug prices. It didn't go anywhere during the Obamacare debate. Pharmaceuticals are a very, you know, heavy lobbying hand here in Washington. And I think you'll see a bit of a fracture on what the different parties want to happen. You might see conservatives and Republicans on the Hill, instead of saying we need to regulate drug prices, they might say, well, we need to deregulate the FDA, that they're keeping these EpiPen alternatives off the market. fit. So I don't know that there will be this cohesive coalition to regulate drug prices. I think you'll see kind of a traditional partisan fracturing about what is the best way to lower drug prices in the United States.
And of course, the whole idea of competition lowering prices only works when there actually is competition in a certain market and not just one company making the product.
Totally. And that's what makes this EpiPen situation a little bit unique, because the drug, as many people pointed out, is generic. It's not new. It's not patented. What's made it a little hard for generic competitors to come in is it appears that the device that EpiPen is in, the thing you use to inject it, that is under patent. So you end up with this weird situation where you have a generic drug that's super cheap to make, but you don't have any generic competitor. You don't have something a pharmacist could substitute because of the, you know, difference of this being an injectable drug versus a tablet that you take.
That's Sarah Cliff, who covers health policy for Vox.com. Sarah, thanks as always.
Yeah, thank you.
Come with me and you'll be in a world of pure imagination. Take a look.
We're all mourning Gene Wilder, who died yesterday at 83. His nephew said he'd withdrawn from the public eye for years because he didn't want kids to think Willy Wonka was dying. He was also Leo Bloom in The Producers, Herr Frankenstein, but he was born Jerry Silberman to Russian Jews who had emigrated to Milwaukee. When he was 8, his mom had a heart attack, and the doctor told Gene, "Don't argue with your mother or you could kill her. Try to make her laugh." And thus was born a soft-spoken, funny actor. Here's a portion of our 2005 conversation when his memoir, Kiss Me Like a Stranger, was released. I started by mentioning that even though he'd once suffered from a serious compulsion to pray that he called the demon, he created one of the funniest monsters on screen in Young Frankenstein. I should mention that your longtime therapist is also featured in your new book. So I'm wondering, am I the first one to draw a line from this childhood demon to Frankenstein?
You are the first.
What do you think?
I don't understand it, but
I thought it could be some sort of exorcism.
No. It was too painful. It was about. It was actually March 21st in my freshman year at the University of Iowa, and I had this compulsion to pray. First, 15 minutes during the day, walking to class, before entering a building, then a half an hour, 2 hours.
What was it?
Well, when it went on for 6 or 7 hours in a row, I didn't think of it as anything holy, and I didn't think it had anything to do with God. I thought it was a horror. And it took 7.5 years of therapy for me to understand that how did I have the right to be happy when my mother was suffering every day of her life? Mm-hmm. So whenever I started to get happy, the compulsion would come in, and I'd start to pray, and it ruined whatever I was doing at the time. Mm-hmm. The only time I felt safe was on stage. They or she or he couldn't get me.
And he eventually went away for good.
Oh, but that was 10 years later.
Yeah. Oh, how weird.
Yeah.
To have that. Well, I'm going to fast you forward because you were on stage.
I'm going to fast forward you.
All right. Whatever.
Fast you. I'm going on a fast, and I don't want to go on a fast yet.
We're going to move into the future. You're on stage in New York performing in a Jerome Robbins production of Mother Courage, starring Anne Bancroft. Jerome Robbins you didn't like.
I realized that he wasn't a good director for drama. For musicals, yes, but for choreography, yes, but not for Bertolt Brecht. But Anne Bancroft's boyfriend was Mel Brooks, and that changed my life probably more than any other thing that happened to me in my early life.
Yeah. Him you liked.
Oh, always, immediately. And he wanted to read the first 30 pages of a screenplay he was working on called Springtime for Hitler. And they were wonderful. It was the opening of the movie of The Producers. And then he said, "Do you want to play the part of Leo Bloom in the movie?" And I said, "Yes, of course I would." And 3 years went by, and I never heard from him. And I was taking off my makeup in a Broadway production of Love, L-U-V, by Murray Schuschnigg. And I heard a knock on the door. I opened the door, and there was Mel with a tall gentleman behind him. And I said, "Mel." He said, "You don't think I forgot, do you?" If I hadn't been miscast in Mother Courage, I wouldn't have been in The Producers or Blazing Saddles or Young Frankenstein or any of it.
Because you wouldn't have met Anne Bancroft's boyfriend.
I wouldn't have met I wouldn't have met Mel Brooks.
We've got a little of Leo Bloom. Let's listen.
"I'm a nothing. I spend my life counting other people's money. people I'm smarter than, better than. Where's my share? Where's Leo Bloom's share? I want everything I've ever seen in the movies.
Leo, say you'll join me.
I'll do it. My God, I'll do it.
What do you think now?
I don't watch myself in the movies.
You don't?
No.
I mean, why would you?
Once in a while, Young Frankenstein. Once in a while.
Because?
Because I always say I could have done that so much better.
No.
Yeah, honestly.
What would you have done better? What? It was a perfect movie.
In the producers, I would say, no, you were good in that. Frisco Kid, I thought I was good in that. But Silver Streak, Stir Crazy, yeah, they're okay, but I could have acted that so much better.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about Young Frankenstein because I think it is the perfect film. How did you come up with the idea?
I took out a yellow legal pad and a blue felt pen, and I wrote at the top, Young Frankenstein. And then I jotted down 2 pages of what I thought might happen to me if I were told that I inherited the estate of my great-grandfather, Beaufort von Frankenstein, but I had to come to Transylvania to collect it and so on. And that was it. And that was heaven on a stick.
One of the greatest scenes. Almost didn't get in because Mel didn't like it originally.
Almost. When he read Puttin' on the Ritz, he said, are you nuts? You can't just suddenly start tap dancing with the monster and so on. I started out slowly. I said, well, I'm trying to prove to the intelligentsia of Transylvania, all these scientists gathered in the theater, that I can make this monster, this creature, a sophisticated person. I argued for about 20, 25 minutes till I was red in the face. I mean, really red in the face. And then he said, okay, it's in. I said, well, why did you put me through this? And he said, because I wasn't sure. And I thought, if he fights for it, it must be right. If he doesn't fight, it's not in. And I fought for it, and so it went in. That's the only argument we ever had.
Hit it!
If you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where fashion sits? Different types who wear a day coat, pants with stripes, or cutaway coat, perfect fits.
Now, that still makes you laugh.
Yes,
that makes me laugh. Doesn't that still
I'm remembering when we did it, too, and how funny it was to hear Peter Boyle saying, it broke me up all the time. At first, it was too tough. I couldn't do it without laughing. Puttin' on the Ritz does make me laugh. I think when Marty and I were pushing the casket down this cobblestone street and it crashed and the monster's arm fell out, and then the constable comes and says, need a hand? I said, no thanks, have one. And I start to pretend that the monster's hand is my hand. That makes me laugh. And Cloris Leachman probably made me laugh more in that film than anyone else, though.
You mean you? You mean he? No. Yes.
Yeah, he was my boyfriend.
There was always so much to talk to Gene Wilder about. We'll post several interviews at hereandnow.org. There was the time he described to director Mel Stewart why Willy Wonka had to make his first appearance from the chocolate factory with a limp and a cane. The waiting crowd would become quiet.
He's crippled. Who thought Willy Wonka was crippled? My goodness. Then my cane gets stuck into a brick, and I do a forward somersault and jump up, and they all applaud. And Mel Stewart said, what do you want to do that for? And I said, because from that time on, no one, not the audience and not the kids, will know whether I'm lying or telling the truth.
And he gave us very personal descriptions of how, as with his mother decades before, he tiptoed around a very ill woman, his beloved wife Gilda Radner, who died of ovarian cancer.
When she was desperately ill, she treated everyone, every stranger she met, with kindness, no matter how much she was suffering, but not me. And she says, don't you understand? You're my husband. You're the only one I can let it out on.
And as you point out at the end of the book, Gilda actually gave you many terrific gifts, but one of them was the title.
3 weeks before she died, she came up to me just out of the blue, said, I have a title for you. Kiss Me Like a Stranger. Maybe you can use it someday.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what she was talking about. I just said, thanks. Thank you, dear. And that was it. And 14 years later, I thought, I'll use the title that Gilda gave me,
Even
though I don't know what she meant by it.
Well, in closing, I thought it was about me. Can we share our story?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
There we are in the 70s. You are promoting your film, The World's Greatest Lover, your sort of take on Valentino. And I'm interviewing you, and you are flinging me around with faux kisses. Oh, yes.
I didn't say no.
Oh, yes. Fast forward 20 years after that, and I saw you walking through an airport, and you had a pork pie hat on and a sort of a...
Salt Lake City?
Yeah. And a sort of a beige khaki suit. You had two leather valises, one in each hand, and you were striding through the airport, purposefully looking down. And I thought, oh, I've got just a second to talk to him. And I ran up alongside you, fell in step with you, and said, Mr. Wilder, I know you don't remember me, but you kissed me once in Boston.
And you said, the last time I saw you,
right. You
kissed me
in Boston. And you said what? You never call?
Oh, yeah.
You never write?
Right. You don't call. You don't write. What kind of a relationship is this?
You never looked up. You never broke stride. Gene, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll begin with a spin, traveling in the world of my creation. What we'll see.
How lucky were we to have him? Our full conversation with Gene Wilder at hereandnow.org.
Explanation.
American shoppers are enjoying what could be the longest streak of falling food prices in a half a century. The cost of milk, eggs, and corn is dropping in part because of weak demand in China. Great news if you are buying a cart of groceries. Terrible news for farmers. Jason Bellini of the Wall Street Journal joins us now. Hi, Jason.
Hi there, Jeremy.
And why is food getting so much cheaper?
So much cheaper. Well, we're reporting that the glut of excess produce is so severe, produce and other agriculture items are so severe that dairy farmers have actually been dumping millions of pounds of excess milk out onto the fields. Mm. So that's never a good situation. You know, a big factor in this is a stronger U.S. dollar. And, you know, farmers, they're not economists, and so they couldn't necessarily foresee that the sale of domestic products overseas would become more difficult, and that would increase the supply of foods on the domestic market, that causing that downward pressure on retail food prices. And economists and food analysts are saying that supermarket price declines, they could last at least through the year end.
And there's no way for farmers to plan for this and decide not to plant as much? Or is that just something that they'll be able to do maybe for next season, but it's too late for this one?
Too late for this one, and you know the situations change pretty quickly. They change; economics can change like the weather, and so you know farmers try to make the best use of the land that they've got and plant as much as they have, and then hope that the prices will deliver profit. And so then, in down years, they buy less new equipment, and that's what some of the farmers we talked to have said is that they're putting off buying that new tractor because they just don't have the money for it right now. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask if this applies to all food, because I have to say I haven't noticed a dramatic drop in prices on most things. I did notice that the eggs I bought the other day were a little less than they have been in the past, but I can't imagine that everybody is seeing this right now.
Well, not everyone everywhere. It's not uniform. And, you know, fruits and vegetable prices are actually up 1.4% from a year ago. And that's partly due to the drought in California. Mm. But nationwide, the price of a gallon of whole milk, that's down an average 11% to about $3.06. You've got a dozen large eggs selling for about 40% less than they did a year ago for $1.55. So why don't you make more omelets and then you'll save some money.
Well, and of course, after having done stories about the conditions of the birds involved in some of the cheaper eggs, I now have to buy the more expensive ones because I feel terrible for them. But let me ask you this, Jason. Is it good overall for the economy for food prices to be low? Because it does give people more money to spend on other things.
It's a mixed bag. You know, deflation is never a good thing in the economy. But right now, you know, the Fed just met and they are happy with where inflation is overall, you know, because food is just one sector of the economy. And, you know, if you're buying other types of things, other consumer goods, you may be paying a little bit more for those and it kind of evens out. But generally for an economy, no, deflation is not a healthy thing. That is the Fed's job is to keep inflation at you know, to have inflation at a healthy rate.
Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal. We'll be watching to see what the Fed plans to do in terms of an increase in the interest rate. We'll be seeing maybe that could happen as soon as next month. Jason Bellini, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
The presidential election has been the most divisive in memory. And in the age of social media, whether you like it or not, you can find heated debate and name-calling every time you log into Facebook. From January 1st through August 1st, 100 million people on Facebook in the U.S. generated 4 billion posts, comments, shares, and reactions about the election. 4 billion. And according to the company, more than 1 billion of those posts occurred in July alone. We're joined by Issy Lapowski, who covers business, tech policy, and the election for Wired. Hi, Issy.
Hi.
So all of those posts, those billions of posts and reactions and all of that about the election, it sounds like it's hurting friendships on Facebook.
I think it really is. And you see that in particular this election cycle because you have two candidates who really have historically low favorability ratings. So I think that it's driving people apart in a different way. In the past, you know, you disagree with your friends about ideology and about policy. But I think this is really getting to sort of a gut instinct level about who these people are as people and whether or not you actually want them as your friends.
What does that tell you, though, that we've gotten to the point where just because somebody likes a different candidate that you want to unfriend them on Facebook?
I think it's not just that somebody likes a different candidate. I think it's these two candidates. People believe that, you know, what you feel about Donald Trump or what you feel about Hillary Clinton actually says something about who you are, because these people are very polarizing figures. Donald Trump's policies are particularly polarizing, and Hillary Clinton, just as a public figure for decades and decades, has been polarizing. So I think that it's driving people apart, not just because it's a different candidate. You know, we've seen past elections, and certainly Obama, Mitt Romney wasn't as contentious as this one. This election season is very ugly, and that's playing out in people's personal lives as well as in the public sphere.
Do we have any data yet about how many people have been unfriended in the course of this election?
I have been asking Facebook that same question, and they say they do not collect data on whether there's an unfriending spike during election cycles. Not sure, you know, whether or not that's true or if they just don't want to show how ugly it can get on their platform. But anecdotally, you know, I've been asking around, and if not unfriending, people are certainly muting other people who they disagree with on Facebook. I think that people feel like Facebook is becoming this place where they log on and suddenly they get really anxious about what they're seeing, and they get nervous when they get a notification on a political post that they've posted. And so they want to sort of remove that anxiety from their daily lives, and they do that by unfriending people in the most extreme cases and muting them in lesser cases.
And of course, this election is not the first time that people have had Facebook for an election, but also for major issues where people come down on both sides. There have been obviously a number of mass shootings in this country, and people start voicing their opinions about gun control and gun rights. The Supreme Court decision on same-sex marriage, people posting on both sides of that issue. But you're saying this is still different.
I think that we've definitely seen a polarization of Facebook friendships when it comes to issues like gun rights. The one thing I will mention about Facebook is a lot of us tend to be in this sort of echo chamber where if we happen to be gun rights supporters, then a lot of our friends are gun rights supporters. If you feel the opposite way, then so do a lot of your friends. And Facebook's algorithms are trained to show you the things that you're most likely to like, the things that you're most likely to share, the things that you're most likely to comment on and agree with. And so I think a lot of us tend to see like-minded views. So becomes all the more shocking when you see something that isn't, because it just seems so out of place. It seems like, who are you showing up in my timeline disagreeing with me and all of my like-minded friends? I think we're definitely seeing that with this election cycle, but you definitely see it with issues like Black Lives Matter and gun rights issues.
It does make you worry about the ability of Facebook to deliver news to people if the algorithm, plus the fact that you might not want to see this opinion or that opinion, is going to make you only see the things that you already agree with.
Right. Facebook has a lot of choices to make around where it sits in the news industry, because it is this huge vehicle for delivering the news now. You know, a huge majority of people, particularly younger people, now get their news primarily from Facebook. And if you're logging onto Facebook believing that you're getting all the news and the most unbiased version of the news, then, yeah, it is a problem because you're not necessarily seeing all the news. You're seeing all the news Facebook thinks you want to see and Facebook thinks you might like. So Facebook's been grappling with that, especially this election cycle. Earlier in the election cycle, they were accused of a bias in their trending topics portal, that they were, you know, limiting how much conservative content was being seen. They've made a lot of changes to their trending topics portal since then, in hopes of fixing that. They invited Republican leaders, conservative thought leaders out to Silicon Valley to meet with them to talk about these issues. So this is something that's definitely on Facebook's mind. It will continue to be.
So, Issy Lepaski, I'm going to ask you to be an advice columnist for us for a second here, because if somebody's listening to this and thinking, well, you know, I hate to admit it, but that's me. I don't want to see things that I don't agree with, and I've unfriended somebody because they've posted something about the candidate that I don't like or something bad about my candidate. What should that person do if they do want to see a wide range of opinions?
I think that your first option is to try to have civil conversations online. I think it's a lot easier for these conversations to get really ugly online than much uglier than they would in person, because you're not looking at somebody face to face. You're not taking in the whole human being. You're just looking at those words in that little chat box, and then you have however much time you need to come up with, you know, the most biting response. I think the more people can treat these conversations in the same way they would in person, that can lead to some more civil discussions, maybe some people seeing eye to eye. I mean, on these most contentious topics, on gun rights, on gay rights, on even election 2016, I think most people's ideas are pretty entrenched. But at least you can preserve your friendships if you approach these conversations in a more civil way.
That's Issy Lepaski, who's a staff writer at Wired. Issy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And you may have seen this on your Facebook feed. The SETI Institute, which is devoted to finding extraterrestrial life in the universe, announced it is investigating reports of an unusual radio signal found in space by Russian astronomers. Kelly Beatty is senior editor at Sky and Telescope. He joins us via Skype. Hi, Kelly.
Hey, nano, nano.
Well, what do we know about these radio signals and SETI's announcement?
You know, this is kind of an oblique kind of report. It's coming by way of, a PowerPoint presentation or something. They used a radio telescope that has a really wide bandwidth. And by that, I mean, it's like you had a radar detector for catching speeders, but you had it set to catch anything from 50 to 150 miles an hour. And it was just a one-time event. It happened in May of last year, and it happens to be in the direction of this star. And the star is known as HD 164595, which is in the constellation Hercules. That is a star very much like the sun and is known to have a planet.
So what are the possibilities for this radio signal?
Well, the possibility that it might be from some alien race is actually very, very low. This planet is much larger than the Earth. It orbits very close to the star, which means it's going to be extremely hot on one side and extremely cold on the other. And the power that would have to be directed toward the Earth from 94 light years away would be just incredible. So although, you know, SETI scientists are being cautious and they're trying to pick up another signal by pointing their telescopes in the same direction, chances are much, much more likely that it was something actually artificial, a satellite that came close to that position. One thing about this Russian telescope is that it doesn't point exactly at one spot in space. It actually gathers data from a pretty good size area. So there are all kinds of reasons that are much more mundane than extraterrestrial life that could work here.
Still, it's reminding a lot of people of the movie Contact, based on the Carl Sagan novel, where a SETI scientist, played by Jodie Foster, finds a signal, evidence of alien life, and is chosen to make first contact. Here's a clip.
NORAD's not tracking any snoops in this vector.
Okay, point source confirmed. Whatever it is, it ain't local.
Position?
I checked into perimetry somewhere in Lyra, I think.
Kelly, when will we know for sure?
You know, I love Contact, and that clip tells you everything you need to know. The signal kept repeating over and over. In this Russian case, it was just one and done. So the first thing we need to do is get another signal, and if it repeats, then we've got something. If not, it's just a false alarm.
That's Kelly Beatty, senior editor at Sky and Telescope. Kelly, thanks as always.
All right, Jeremy, take care.
And for many of us in parts of the country, this is the saddest time of year, our last chance to get the taste of summer right from the ground in the form of a tomato. You slice it right off the vine, a dash of pepper. Sorry, I'm getting carried away here.
I think so. You can do a lot with tomatoes, though. And in fact, our resident chef, Kathy Gunst, has some great ideas for tomatoes. Kathy, great to see you.
Hey, Jeremy. Hello, Robin.
And I have to say, I am such a big tomato fan that I actually know the code at the supermarket for the vine-ripe tomatoes. It's 466. For. Now, the ones you have here look actually much fancier
than that.
There's
no code for these tomatoes because they came from my garden this morning. Yeah, it's a sad time of year, but I'm in complete denial, as I am every year around Labor Day. It's like, nope, summer is not over. There are still many beautiful days. But in terms of gardening, tomatoes are at their absolute finest. They've had all summer to soak in the sun, the heat of the earth, and they are just popping. I have more than I can handle right now. They're in farmers markets. The prices come down. And you mean, as you said, you make a tomato sandwich, put it on a good slice of bread with salt and pepper, and you're in heaven. But there's so much more, as you see in front of you.
Okay, well, start with this.
Let's start with that.
Multicolored salad.
Isn't it gorgeous? So I have a few different types of tomatoes. We have cherry tomatoes, yellow and red ones. And then we have green zebra tomatoes, red zebra, black crimp. Red zebra. Look for those. Mm. Those are low acid and fabulous. That means, not a super acidic tomato.
That's true. The different color means something?
Well, it doesn't necessarily mean the color, but every variety has a different acidity, a different level of sweetness. So in all my recipes, I ask people to try to use a variety so that you will balance them out. Not only do you get color and texture, but different flavors and sweetness. So that's a late season tomato with fresh plums.
Well, I was going to say, what's this very, very dark tomato?
Yes, that is a plum.
Delicious.
One night I was making a tomato salad and thought to throw in a plum, and my world just opened up.
You mean you just picked one up and you thought it was a tomato, but actually it was a plum.
This is just the day in the life of a food writer, okay? This is how these things happen.
It really makes a difference.
Isn't
and
it?
I would have never thought of that, but that is a great idea for a salad.
That is why I am here.
That's why you're here.
So plums and tomatoes, you could also throw in a peach. In New England, we have no peaches. We don't even have to go into that, but it's so sad. And then I sprinkled it with a little blue cheese and just some oil and vinegar. So it is. We have a recipe for you, but it's kind of a non-recipe.
Right. Just make your own.
And it's up at hereandnow.org.
Okay.
Next to that is I'm so excited about this recipe. This is a corn and roasted tomato tart. Mm. The pastry I made, you don't have to get all freaked out. Like, I'm not going to make pastry. You could use a pre-made pastry. But what's special about making your own is that I added lots of fresh garden thyme. So you taste the herb in the crust. Mm-hmm. And then you've got fresh corn shucked right off the cob with some roasted cherry tomatoes, a little Parmesan cheese. I love that. That's dinner. That's lunch.
So simple. How long?
How long did it take to make or bake? Took me 2 minutes, but it takes about an hour.
Yeah, to
put everything together. You can make everything ahead of time, bake it right before dinner, and you've got this gorgeous main course. Corn and tomatoes, there's no better way to celebrate the end of summer.
And finally here, you've got this. If people know what a Le Creuset pot looks like,
yes,
this is like the cutest little baby one.
I knew you'd like that. And isn't it adorable?
You can see it on our website, hereandnow.org, or on our Facebook page, facebook.com/hereandnowradio. But what do you have in here, Kathy?
I have a puttanesca sauce, a classic Southern Italian sauce. as I said, have so many tomatoes, and I don't have the patience or the time to do the traditional sauce where you peel them and you seed them. I take all my tomatoes, I chop them up, and I roast them at a very high temperature. I've talked about this over the years. But puttanesca, which means politely ladies of the evening or otherwise in the style of prostitutes.
What?
Yes, that is what it literally means. That is the translation. I don't make this stuff up. So you've got roasted tomatoes and onions and olive oil, but you have anchovies and capers and fresh basil, and you can can this or you can freeze it. But on top of linguine or spaghetti.
This is so good.
Yeah, for you, I just have a little olive oil brushed piece of toast, but I could just drink that stuff straight.
What do you do about people? You mentioned anchovies and capers. Some of these people think, well, anchovies especially, they think they don't like them. I'm not really tasting. I know what's in there.
You taste salt.
Yeah.
That's what you taste. You don't taste fish or fishiness. And that is something people, oh no, leave anchovies out of mine. And then I serve this and I don't say anything because I'm that kind of mean hostess. And, and they're like, oh, this is so good. I love the salt. And then a minute later, I'll say, you love anchovies, actually. So don't be scared of it. But you can certainly leave the anchovies out.
And you say you can freeze this, which is great. So you keep this summer taste. We got about a minute. Quick ideas.
My favorite quick late August dinner is to boil up some linguine, chop about 5 different fresh tomatoes, fresh basil, olive oil, saute some garlic, and that's it. And the hot pasta tossed with the raw tomato sort of creates this instant sauce, and it's just about as great as you can get.
Can you ever have too many tomatoes?
No.
Never. Never.
The acidity
and can summer ever last too long? No. Summer food just it's the best. And tomatoes, the best way to celebrate it.
And we've got the recipes we've been talking about and some photos at our website, hereandnow.org. Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst, who's the author of the upcoming book, Soup Swap. Kathy, thank you so much.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Just amazing.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm done. It's so good. It's Here and Now.